All right, welcome to the Adonis Lifestyle Podcast. I'm John Barbin, and with me is a buddy of mine, Dave Gunderman, and he actually does his research in, I guess, muscle metabolism, skeletal muscle metabolism. And we were just going to talk about, I have Dave on to talk about the mechanisms of muscle growth and basically muscle metabolism and to dig in a little bit to what's going on academically or at least on the research side of things as compared to what we would hear in the mainstream media. I'm flying solo on this one. Howard has got this one off, so it'll just be me and Dave. So Dave, can you give us the really short version of the type of research you guys are doing?
Sure. We look at muscle growth at a more of acute level. What makes our lab more unique is that instead of essentially training people over a period of days and weeks and trying to see how larger muscles get, we're actually able to look at one bout of exercise and see how the synthesis of that muscle actually resulted from one bout of exercise. And there's not a lot of labs in the world that really are able to do this, so it makes our lab relatively unique.
Okay, so that's like acute, like literally one bout, and then you're studying the muscle right afterwards, or during, or both.
Actually, before, during, and after. What we do is we infuse a subject with what we consider tracers. They're actually labeled amino acids that actually we can trace and follow around the body. And we can take a series of muscle biopsies, and before exercise, you can see the level of incorporation of these amino acids. And then after exercise, you can see the level of incorporation of these amino acids. And you actually can tell, you know, based on that one intervention you have, how much synthesis actually increased based on this one exercise. So we're able to actually compare one exercise versus another exercise, or even nutrition. We can, you know, feed someone amino acids or a protein drink, and you can see how that can actually increase protein synthesis. And, you know, we feel that that is a better indicator of how, you know, muscle, how a specific intervention will actually unravel in terms of muscle growth, instead of doing a longitudinal study when you can't really control a lot of the different variables that exist with a training study.
Yeah, exactly. Like you can't. It's super hard to control someone's diet, or if they're drinking, or if they're just having a lousy day, or not getting good sleep. It's, you know, 12 weeks later, it's really hard to control that stuff. I'm with you on that one.
In general, like, you know, everyone has different motivation levels, and I mean, half these measurements are like strength measurements, and, you know, how do you really accurately measure someone's strength? Because half the strength has to do with your own nervous system's ability to push your muscles.
Oh yeah, and then how well you've been trained on the technique of that exercise, and how good your form is, and literally how good you feel that day.
Exactly. And so there's a lot of different variables. So if you take all the variables out of it and look at seriously one bout of exercise, if you can manipulate, you know, the intensity of exercise, number of reps of exercise, and you really can see how this exercise actually caused a level of synthesis. You can compare different interventions against each other.
All right. So can you mentioned biopsies. I don't know if our listeners might not even know what that is. Could you walk us through just a general, like,
sure.
Someone's coming in the lab and they're getting biopsied. Like, give us, make.
You want the whole day?
Make the listener be the subject and kind of walk them through what it would be like to go through one of these studies.
Okay. So our subjects actually arrive the night before because we want them in a fasted state. We know that actually feeding a subject actually will increase protein synthesis. So we feed them a meal like at 10 o'clock the night before, and we let them fast throughout the night, and we actually enter into the lab in the morning. We hook up all the amino acid traces, so we get that infused right away. And let that sit, you know, infusing for at least a couple hours before we even do anything, just so that there's a certain level of amino acids in the bloodstream. So initially we take literally a chunk of muscle out of their leg. So it starts with we actually have 1% lidocaine, which is an anesthetic that actually numbs up the little area of the leg. We actually biopsy through the vastus lateralis, which is a muscle in your thigh.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual process only takes a matter of 5 minutes. You numbed up the leg, you stick a needle in your leg, and it's actually a hollow needle. You open up a little window, and you perform a series of cuts around this muscle, and you pull the needle, and we then extract it and actually divide it up into different tubes and freeze them in liquid nitrogen. Now, in our studies, we actually do 5 biopsies throughout the day. 2 of them before the exercise, because like I said before, we need a rate of synthesis before exercise even starts. So we need two biopsies, approximately 2 hours apart, just to see how much the basal level of these amino acid tracers are incorporated into muscle.
Right, and this is what you're going to be comparing to at later, right?
Yes, that's correct. So then, usually around noonish is when we actually get to the actual exercise. Now, every study is different depending on if we're doing an exercise study or a nutrition study or whatever it is that we think that we're going to actually stimulate some muscle growth.
Mm-hmm.
They do that. The exercise is seriously just, you know, one belt, which can be, let's say, four sets of exercise. That all varies depending on the actual protocol.
Sure.
And then we look at a series of samples of muscle afterwards. So in the study I'm doing right now, look at 15 minutes after exercise, see if there's any changes in some of the signaling proteins. And I can talk about the signaling proteins later. And then I look at 1 hour after and 3 hours after. There's some other studies that look at 6 hours after and even 24 hours after. And because a lot of these signals, basically your muscle communicating with itself to know when to actually start synthesizing, are still elevated at least 24 hours after exercise is even completed.
Right. Okay. And then with that data, we're gonna the idea is to see what protocol had what effect.
Right. So we take these muscle biopsies essentially we do a variety of things with them. The first is that fractional synthetic rate was actually analyzing the amino acids in the actual muscle tissue. It's a pretty complicated process. I don't want to get too much into the details of that. It involves mass spectroscopy. The second thing that we do is we take another, I guess, subset of this muscle and we analyze some of the signals. I mentioned that before. There are a variety of different communicating proteins, as you can call them, that really translate the actual exercise to muscle growth. So this is all what happens before muscle even starts to synthesize.
Right.
You have to activate a cascade of different communicating signals. And once we realize that some of these signals that are devoted to muscle growth, and that's what really leads to muscle protein synthesis. In our research, we've realized that it kind of centralizes over one central hub, that if there's one single protein, essentially an enzyme, that if it's activated, you will presumably increase muscle synthesis.
So you're kind of zeroing in on what the rate limiting step was.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And that's where you guys are getting to with what you're kind of looking at right now.
Right. And another thing, what we're doing is we do a lot of mechanistic work, and there's not a lot of people that actually look at specific mechanisms, because really to analyze a mechanism, you need to essentially block it and see that no matter what you do, you can't synthesize a new protein. So what we've done, there are a couple studies that we've done, is we blocked this, you know, central hub communicator and realized that even after exercise or any nutrition, muscle growth won't happen. So we've actually isolated a limiting signal that is essential for muscle growth.
Right. Yeah. And I like the way you explained that. You take it away, and that's the way you can tell if it's having an effect or not.
Right.
Right. All right. So, well, I mean, that might have been a bit technical for everyone, but I think people, and that's good, because I want to show people how technical this actually is. Like, it's not just go to the gym and grow. Like, there's a lot of,
right.
it's really hard to study that. So we're just trying to get down to the nuts and bolts of how much more complicated testing muscle growth is, because like you said, it's basically impossible to control a long-term weight training study, but everyone's weight training. So, I guess this is a good segue into, you know, you're kind of like me. You work out and you're in great shape and you've spent some time building muscle. So what's the difference in your perception of weight training and muscle growth from before when you were an undergrad and now you're, you know, in the middle of high level research like this? What's your view of training and muscle growth now?
I guess personally, I'm more focused on the different kinds of proteins that our muscles can make. I would say that most of my knowledge in terms of actual weight training actually exists where your muscle can adapt in multiple different ways. You know, like endurance athletes aren't actually big, but actually synthesizing proteins, but they're synthesizing different proteins. Someone who's a power lifter is strong, but actually stronger than they are big. So they're actually synthesizing other proteins. But someone who's actually growing muscle, and we call hypertrophy, is growing a complement of a variety of different proteins. So to really activate a variety of different proteins, that it requires a specific training style. So that's something that I think I've learned through the education. Your body will always adapt to what it needs the most. If you're constantly doing high repetitions, strength, and to do high repetitions, you'd have to lower the weight a little bit, and to such the fact that the strength isn't the limiting factor. Instead, the energy that your muscles are creating would be the limiting factor. So your muscles will actually adapt to increase the, essentially the oxygen carrying capacity of the muscle, or to increase the blood flow to that muscle, instead of actually increasing the strength. A power lifter needs increased strength, but they don't need increased endurance. So actually they will replace some of those endurance proteins and replace them with strength proteins. But someone who wants to really grow to like to grow muscle would need a complement of both. And that's why you know, we're still trying to figure out what the best way to grow all the proteins are.
Okay, so then it is all about a mix.
It is in fact. Right.
Okay, so then as far as training goes, it makes sense to have some higher rep stuff and some lower rep stuff.
It would, yeah, because you want to adapt both sides of the spectrum.
Right. And then and just to be clear, when you were comparing the endurance, you meant like endurance athletes like runners and things like that.
Right, yeah. I mean, essentially, endurance runners is just a far extreme of a very light weight with a high repetitions, right?
Right. So somewhere, and this is something we've all been, like, this is basically the $64,000 question. Everyone's looking for what's that exact rep and set and rest scheme and sort of periodized program that maximizes hypertrophy.
Right. And I had a little bit of an issue about that. Like, classically, what they say is that if you fatigue between 8 to 12 reps, you're kind of in the middle of where strength training is far lower than that, and muscular endurance is a little bit higher than that. So 8 to 12 reps kind of be right in the middle, supposedly, you know, the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that it's kind of half-assed of both worlds, where I would prefer to exercise at both 5 reps and 15 reps rather than just maintain repetitions at 8 and 12.
Right. So you're saying that you want to stimulate the muscle specifically in all of those areas, not like the middle gets you, like you said, half-assed at both.
Right.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I mean, and empirically, I mean, I don't know if it bears out in the research, but empirically, that seems to be what needs to take place. You have to have some heavy, heavy stuff, and you have to have some lighter stuff. I don't see how just 8 to 10 reps constantly, I don't know how that could possibly work long term. It seems like you have to add in both ends.
For sure, yeah. And there's a variety of ways you can do it. I mean, like I know you sometimes do, you know, the low and the high reps within the same workout. But another way you can do is you can do a series of workouts with just high reps, and then afterward do a series of workouts with just low reps. And you can really train both sides independently.
Yeah, I don't know how much you've seen of the newer systems we put together, but we have that in there now. We've got it. We've got weeks on end where you're going high and weeks on end when you're going low, and then we've added in ones where, like you said, we've got it periodized every which way possible now. We've got it periodized over the week, over a month, and then also right within the same workout. So I know that's a bit of a carpet bomb approach, but at least we're getting it all in there. And I think people will respond slightly differently to each style too.
Yeah, it's definitely a good possibility. I think in terms of the research I do, we find responders, non-responders, super responders to everything that we do. In fact, there's papers out there that look at the variety of responses of humans, because human beings are actually the worst people, things to study, because nothing's ever consistent. Some people respond greatly, some people don't respond very well at all. And so it could be an individual, I guess, project to see, you know, how you respond to a different sort of exercise. So, I mean, I guess just experiment with yourself and see where you see the most growth.
Yeah, so on that, that's a great point, and that's something people don't get, is that no matter what you think you've heard or what you've seen or what even the research says on a particular protocol, there's still something, and I've only recently discovered this, that there really is a huge range of responders versus non-responders, and like you said, super responders. And that – is there any – have they – I don't know if you would even know this, but is there at least any data growing on how or why certain people are hyper-responders versus others, or is that still to be determined?
I mean, I know it's been characterized. The mechanism, I wouldn't be able to help you out there.
Yeah, so it's yet to be determined as why certain people respond. So I suppose if you've noticed that you're a responder, good for you. And if you're – and non-responders doesn't mean you'll never get anywhere. It just means it's normal for people to be kind of across the spectrum, I guess is what we're trying to say.
Right, and I'm sure there's, you know, someone who responds in one sort of exercise or let me back it up. If someone doesn't respond in one kind of exercise, maybe they will respond in another kind of exercise. It's not like they're globally a non-responder. Maybe they just have to find what it is that they respond at.
Yeah, it's like specific response. Yeah. Oh, and I think most guys recognize that. Like, if guys who've been around the block in the gym a few times probably know the rep ranges they just like being in and the rep ranges that they don't like being in. And I would guess that the rep ranges they, you know, guys who just really enjoy the 5-rep stuff and hate the 13 and 20s, my guess is they like it because they respond to it. And then they feel like they're getting more progress in that rep range versus the other one. Either that or it's the pain, but I'm sure to some degree it's a response thing. Because why wouldn't you want to gravitate to the reps that seem to be working best for you?
Yeah, either that or they just like lifting really heavy weight.
Yeah, I feel it has something to do with mental fatigue to some degree too. Like some guys I know that are like ADD type personalities just can't really put up with more than 5 or 6 reps. It literally, they don't have the patience for it.
Right. Nervous system sometimes is underappreciated in terms of its ability to motivate you. Like, you sometimes think that really you have conscious control of how motivated you are. But if you do high intense exercise, let's say 6 days a week, for weeks and weeks on end, you can't actually keep up that intensity. And the thing that will fail will be your central nervous system. It actually needs a period to just chill out and relax.
Right, now that's actually a really good point. So would that be a shift of intensity, a full break, a different style of frequency? Like, what would you? I guess where would you go with that? I mean, we have our programs are undulating and they're periodized, and we never have anyone in one particular style for more than 4 weeks, anyways. And then I kind of leave it up to everyone to decide when they want to take a full type of week off, and people can feel it. But I agree with you 100% that your nervous system will fatigue. Where would you where do you land on that as far as what actually determines rest from that? Is it just a shift of intensity or range, or is it a full break? Or
well, what I do is you say you have 4 week periodizations. I actually kind of switch every 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. After 9 weeks, what I do is I take 1 week off, and I consider it a strategic deconditioning, where you just completely just take 1 week off. 1 week off every 10 weeks is actually not a big deal, so I don't really feel too bad about missing the training that week, and then start over the system again after that.
Mm-hmm. So you've got an even tighter periodization cycle than we do. You're at 3 and we're at 4, and you take the full break at 9, where we kind of break at 12. So, but similar, right? Okay. So, yeah, I guess we're on the same page with that. I guess we should start wrapping it up here. What would you as far as where the research is and as far as muscle growth compared to the claims that we hear about in the industry, what's your sort of take home message as far as? I mean, to me, I just tell people it's consistency and push hard, and sort of a periodized program that's got variety is what I tell people is the best. Do you have any other tips? Like, I mean, I also tell people to use creatine. Is there anything else that you'd like throw in there?
Well, I mean, a good diet, I think, is something that needs a little more attention. People will consume, let's say, a lot of mass amounts of protein, but it's not necessarily the quantity of protein you eat, but how far you can spread it out. It's been known that 30 grams of protein will stimulate these signaling proteins to increase muscle growth. Any more than that, not too much extra. But what's interesting is if you take 30 grams of protein in the morning and 30 grams of protein in the afternoon, and then again 13 grams of protein in the evening, you can triple up the number of times you increase the protein synthesis, whereas people may not consume as much protein in the breakfast as they do for dinner, let's say, and they think, you know, if I eat tons of protein for dinner, it'll kind of make up for it. But if you can spread out your protein consumption, it actually will increase your ability to stimulate the synthesis of muscle.
So that's a good one. That's something that we've never really touched on. So there's a good tip Dave just gave you. So, and then that becomes that fits into the practicality side. Are people actually eating at those times? Which most people are. Most people are at least eating three times a day. So that's actually not that difficult to adhere to as far as a recommendation goes.
So as long as you can supplement some protein in meals that may not be as protein heavy.
Yeah, exactly. Like if all you're going to do is have some yogurt, maybe toss in some protein powder, and then sure. I guess from that standpoint, you're sort of maxing out what you can do from that side.
Right.
All right, buddy. Thanks. Thanks for the talk. You got anything else you want to, you know, anything, a tip or anything else you want to leave off on?
Not that I can think of.
All right, buddy. Well, thanks a lot. So for Dave Gunderman, I'm John Barbin, and that was your Adonis Lifestyle Podcast.